it was missing. They didn't. It was subleased to a private contractor. I noticed a few cracks as I stared at the ceiling in my office and listened to him. That's the way these big operations work. They order up a bunch of this stuff if they get even an inkling that they might need it, because unlike the rest of us, they don't wait on anything.
I see.
But then they got all this equipment lying around that they're not using and start thinking about recouping their losses. Well, the small operators are desperately in need of the equipment, but the big companies have it all tied up. So they have to go to them with their hats in their hands, and then the big boys overcharge them to get back some of the lease money they lost.
Who was the subcontractor?
An even bigger Brazilian company called Petrobras, but then they subleased the bit to a company called...
No offense, Tuff, and I really appreciate your efforts, but...
He laughed. 17 more leases.
You're kidding.
I want a raise.
I offer you a rug.
The final operator was a... He read from the paper. DT Enterprises.
Never heard of them.
Me neither, but there are a ton of these little wildcat operations down there. It's like the Wild West.
And you are telling me this because...
These operators are not the best bookkeepers, because it is sometimes not beneficial to these operators to have the best books kept.
I'll buy you a lamp to go with the rug.
You're going to have to do better than that. You're going to have to find somebody else to work down here.
I was mildly shocked. Are you quitting on me?
Nope, but Freimeyer is. He dropped off a letter for you this afternoon. I guess him and the fiancée are moving down to Colorado. He says he can stick around for another week if you need him.
Do we need him?
Well, things are heating up around here, but I figure I can handle it.
Any more contact with the East Spring Bunch?
Nope. After you helped them get that piece of shit Plymouth going, they just headed on down the road.
What did you do with the bit?
I got it locked up in the back of the Suburban with my dirty laundry on top of it.
Sounds safe.
I wouldn't touch it unless I had to. As I thought about some of the things Sheriff Crutchley had said, I spotted one of the 45 dum-dum rounds that must have rolled off the top of my desk. I picked it up and held it in front of my face. Neville Bertie Clay, the British Army officer who had worked at the dum-dum arsenal near Calcutta, had developed the hollow or soft-point bullet that to this day carried the arsenal's name. The things should have been called Bertie Birdies.
Walt?
Yep.
Anything else?
The British had used the ammunition in the venerable 303 against Asians and Africans because it had sufficient enough stopping power to deter a determined charge. The Hague Convention of 1899 had found the dum-dum too cruel for use against fellow European countries, but some police departments still authorize them because they mostly do not pass through intended targets and continue on into innocent bystanders.
Sheriff?
I'd seen what they could do in Vietnam and the fistfuls of flesh they removed.
Yep.
Hey, where is DT Enterprises licensed? There was a pause.
Mexico?
Where in Mexico? There was more paper rustling on his end.
Chihuahua.
Where the dogs come from.
I guess. See what you can dig up on them. Roger that. Anything else?
Start taking applications down there, would you? He laughed.
Yeah, okay. Why don't you just send Vic? I've got my cot set up in the back.
I don't think that would work out, but don't worry, I'm going to call in some reinforcements.
He chuckled on the other end. Smoke signals or war drums?
Double Tough knew my methods. I'll let you know. I hung up the phone and moved it off my chest, crossed my arms, and tried to think once again about my dwindling staff. But DT Enterprises kept getting in the way. Why did that sound familiar? Was it something somebody with Lanier had said? I didn't think so. Maybe it wasn't the Enterprises part. DT. Sancho came in and sat on the corner of my desk with a sheaf of papers under his arm, one hand cupped around some aspirin and a glass of water in the other.
You sleeping down there tonight?
Dog followed him in and sat by my desk. Just me and my faithful companion.
Sit up and take your medicine. Ruby's orders.
I took the 4 aspirin and the glass from him and leaned against the bookcase where I'd started the day.
Thanks.
And I swallowed. Everybody gone? Cord is still working over at the Busy Bee, and Mr. Rockwell is reading about himself in his cell. He studied my quizzical look. Ruby went over to the library and picked up all the books they had on Orrin Porter Rockwell and gave them to him.
How's he doing?
He's been awfully depressed since Vic arrested him, but I think he appreciated the books.
He smiled, and I couldn't help but think how handsome that face would be on a sheriff's election poster. Bishop Goodman came by, and they talked for about 4 hours. I laughed. Our bishop may be fianchettoed. Huh? A chess move where the bishop can form a long diagonal defense of a castled king. Anyway, I think the good bishop wants to write a book about Orrin Porter Rockwell, and the prisoner in question might be a shortcut in the research department. He seems to know an awful lot about him.
That he does. Any word on who he really is?
I tried to get his fingerprints, but he resisted, so I took them off a glass of water. I glanced at the one in my hand.
Remind me to never get on your bad side.
He pulled the papers from his underarm and looked at them. It makes for some interesting reading.
I studied the Basco's face. Oh, now, why don't I like the sound of that?
Well, you know we're limited to service personnel and criminals on the fingerprint bank.
Right.
Well, I got nothing.
So he's clean?
Not exactly.
He flipped one of the pages over and handed it down to me as dogs settled in and stretched out, figuring we were here for the long haul. There was an enlarged, washed-out, mimeographed 2x2 photo, not unlike the one that had accompanied Sizer Pretoria's resume from the Wyoming State Prison in Rawlins back when he'd been attempting to flee working in corrections. The man in the photo was trim, young, and straining with wiry muscle. There was an intensity in the light opal-like eyes that was hard to miss and still in evidence. His hair was so close-cropped to the side of his head that his ears looked like he was cleared for takeoff. Ears I thought I'd seen somewhere before on someone else.
The official form from Ellsworth Air Force Base was a military identification for the year 1957, but stated that all information was classified.
Intelligence.
Maybe, maybe not. He tapped the papers in his hand. I had a friend at the National Personnel Record Center who found this in the files that said he was on loan to Civil Air Transport under the auspices of the American Airedale Corporation. Get it? Airedale?
No.
You will. 2 years later, Civil Air Transport and American Airedale changed their name to the much-storied Air America. I knocked the receiver off the phone.
CIA?
Spooky as the night is long. He laughed. Up to 62, he flew direct and indirect support for CIA ops ambidextrous, Hotfoot and White Star, and then trained the Royal Laotian Armed Forces. After that, he was involved with something called Project 404 as an air attaché to the U.S. Embassy in Vientiane, and then he provided logistical support to the Royal Lao and Hmong armies under the command of General Vang Pao.
I'm sure what the Basco had discovered was pretty important, but I was getting a little tired of all the dramatics. Come on, CIA.
Wait, there's more. His eyes returned to the paper. He was shot down in 64 while making what they called a hard rice support run in the mountains, dropping off weapons to tribal leaders who were opposed to the North Vietnamese. He was listed MIA, but by the end of the war in 73, he was listed as a war casualty. Okay, so jump cut to this Vista volunteer working in Vietnam, who happens to see this white guy with a beard and long hair working on a prison road crew in 75, and goes over to him and asks him his name.
Yep.
The guy looks up slow, and has some trouble getting his voice and remembering how to speak English, before telling the kid his nickname. Airedale.
I don't get it.
From Short Drop, Wyoming.
I stared at him.
Dale, Airedale, Tisdale.
D.T. Enterprises. Chapter 11. Henry sipped his beer and leaned back in Ruby's chair. The woman who owns the mercantile, his wife Eleanor, says he died in a plane crash in Mexico.
I glanced back at him.
Yep, but he supposedly died crashing a plane in North Vietnam, too. Seems to me he's made a habit of crashing and dying all over the globe. The bear, the Basco, and I had been surprised to find a few Rainiers in the commissary icebox, and were sitting in the dispatcher's area at the front of the office like truants.
Sancho sat on the bench by the steps and turned the copy of Tisdale's faded black-and-white headshot in his hands, then stretched an arm out and forced Henry and me to stare it in the eye. Tell me that's not him.
The thing looked like a photo of a ghost. The eyes were the same, but the identifying feature was the ears. Ears exactly like his grandson's.
So what's he doing flying around Mexico? You tell me.
The bear added, and dead, no less. I thought about it. If he's Sarah Tisdale's father, then he had to be back here in Wyoming for at least a night.
Sizer Vittoria sipped his Rainier.
Uh-huh.
You thinking what I'm thinking?
He looked at the can.
That this is the shittiest tasting beer ever? That's not what I'm thinking.
The Cheyenne Nation chuckled, and I took a long swig out of my own can, just to make a point.
That he was still on the company payroll down in Mexico.
Sancho belched and made a face.
Lawyers, guns, and money?
I guess I need to talk to Eleanor Tisdale. Not that I'm looking forward to it. The Basco nodded his head, knocked on the bench as if it were a door, and broke into a faux, flowery announcer voice.
Mrs. Tisdale, we're sorry to report that we think your daughter's dead, but guess who we have behind door number two?
I sighed, and he continued, You guys know anybody at the CIA? Henry and I glanced at each other, and then I pulled out my pocket watch. As a matter of fact, we do.
Wally was surprised to see me at 8 o'clock at night at the door of the main house at the Lazy DW, but maybe even more surprised to see the Cheyenne Nation. The patrician-looking silver-haired man led us into their den, where Donna sat with a wine glass of sparkling water at her side. I noticed that she casually flipped the top sheet of a prodigious stack of papers to keep the bear and me from seeing the title.
Are those your memoirs? She laughed.
Something like that.
She and her husband made eye contact for a moment, and then Wally gave us a brief nod and left. Looking at all the stacks of books, photos, plaques, and awards that the woman had accumulated over the years, my eyes wandered around the crowded room. Donna with Presidents Nixon, Kennedy, and Johnson. Donna with ex-senators. Donna with movie stars. I pointed toward the one of Donna and LBJ standing together.
Relation?
She smiled. Nope, but he gave me the best advice I ever got about public life.
And what was that?
You know, Walt, never turn down the opportunity of a free meal or a chance to go to the bathroom. There was another photograph near where Henry sat of Donna in a parka and a man in army fatigues and an airborne cap. The bear reached over and tapped the glass protecting the black-and-white photo of the two, who were seated with a snow-capped mountain in the background.
Is that Larry Thorne?
The man who brought modern skiing into the United States Army, despite the United States Army?
Sure is.
Donna smiled and pulled her chair closer, plucking the frame from the wall, turning it over, and handing it to Henry. Recovery mission. The bodies from a military transport that crashed on an Iranian glacier in 63. There was bad weather, and I radioed him to see if he wanted to wait on the operation. The weather got worse and transmission got sketchy, but I finally got through and Larry asked me if we wanted them to put the bodies back. They'd already gone up and gotten them. The bear carefully returned the photo to the wall.
He was the only white man that ever outran me.
Fort Bragg? Henry nodded.
Twice our age, and he could run all of us into the ground.
The bear glanced back at the photo, the man's features looking like they'd been carved from soapstone.
There were rumors that he was a Nazi.
Donna laughed. He was from Finland. Johnson settled back into her chair and stared at her lap. Lowry Turney. He fought against the Soviets when they invaded Finland. Then, when the Germans invaded Russia, the Finns went after what they'd lost to the Russians. She looked up at us. The friend of a friend is a friend, the friend of an enemy. She didn't have to finish the proverb. Anyway, after the war, Wild Bill Donovan, who knew what Turney was worth, got him and shipped him off to North Carolina as a citizen and second lieutenant with a new name, Larry Thorne. She smiled at the Cheyenne Nation. And that's probably where you met him.
Henry grinned at the thought of the man and then stiffened.
He was the first study and observations group personnel to be listed as MIA.
It was the first time I'd heard the bear use the proper name of his old outfit, SOG. Evidently, he was feeling comfortable with the reclusive ranch woman.
Hey, Donna,
She turned to look at me. I've never asked you what it was you did with the government, and to be honest, I really don't want to know. But it's getting late. I don't want to keep you till tomorrow, and I've got a situation on my hands that I need some help with. She adjusted her glasses, looking for the entire world like some Harvard Don. Does this concern the My Friend Flicker boy and that man?
As a matter of fact, it does.
She nodded, and I could see her weighing the options. How can I help?
I explained the situation, indicating that my only interest was in finding out what was going on in my county concerning the boy, a missing woman, and a bad feeling I had about the whole Apostolic Church of the Lamb of God.
She glanced at a fancy computer monitor and the stacks of papers she'd casually covered up, and all I could think was that these might not be the first things Donna Johnson had been responsible for covering up.
Why don't you show me what you've got?
I reached in my jacket and pulled out the folded papers that Sizer Vittoria had given me. The Basco had pleaded with us to take him, but I'd told him that if Donna had to kill us after giving us the information we'd requested, it might be better if he went home to his wife and child. Johnson took them, stared at the photo first, and then flipped through the pages. Who collated this information?
My deputy, Sizer Vittoria.
Donna studied the papers, her eyes sliding over them like fingers sweeping keys on a piano.
He's very capable, this young man.
I nodded and compressed my lips.
Does that mean you have to kill us?
Donna smiled. Not yet. She looked at me. If I do this for you, you mustn't let anyone know that I've done it. Anyone at all. I'm very serious. I kept my eyes locked on hers, just to demonstrate the severity of the promise.
Agreed.
She glanced at the bear, who crossed his heart.
Honest Injun.
She smiled and gave a definitive nod of her head. Well, it will take a little time, so why don't you gentlemen adjourn to the kitchen for a few moments? Have you eaten?
Antelope ravioli. I made it myself.
Sitting around the counter in the kitchen of the Lazy DW, I had to admit that the impromptu meal was one of the finest I'd ever eaten.
Wally, thanks. You really didn't have to feed us.
Oh, I don't mind. It gives me something to do. Gardening is over, and things get a little boring this far out from town.
I studied him, enjoying the camaraderie of being in his kitchen. Donna's family had had the ranch for as long as there had been a county, and as near as I could remember, they had both known my late wife. A lot of men would have had a problem being Donna's husband on a lot of counts, but Wally seemed to wear the mantle easily. Nonetheless, it's kind of you to take us in on such short notice. Henry scraped the remains of the ravioli from his plate and licked his fork clean.
This was delicious. I could not have done better myself. Antelope is tricky.
I sipped the fancy beer that Wally had poured out of a growler and smiled at him.
That was a supreme compliment.
He sipped his wine and studied the bear and then me.
I assume that all this has to do with that young man, Cord.
I was surprised he remembered his name, but then they probably didn't get that many horse thieves around these parts.
Tucked in and sleeping at the jail.
Is he still fixated on My Friend Flicker?
He and his friend were watching it again when we left.
He nodded. The crazy one that thinks he's Orin Porter Rockwell.
Yep.
It's an interesting life you lead, Walt.
I meet a lot of people.
I set my stylish royal pint glass down.
So is your wife? I glanced around, just to impress on him and the Cheyenne Nation that I could be covert, too.
Is she really writing a book?
God help us.
He rested an elbow on the cherry counter. For the last 10 years. The bear interrupted.
Tell her not to feel bad. I cannot type either.
He laughed. It's the company censors. The last time she turned in 605 pages, they returned 202.
Ouch.
But she's decided to attack the problem from a different angle.
How so?
She's writing it as a spy thriller.
Fiction?
Yes. She's just changing all the names to protect the not-so-innocent. Most of the fact-checkers at Quantico are so young they won't have any idea what Donna's writing about. But it should send a shiver through the intelligence community.
A voice sounded from behind us. Are you telling all my secrets, hon?
He tipped the bottle of Domaine de la Solitude and poured her a glass.
Just the ones I know, dear. Donna sat on the stool beside him. The file on Dale, Airedale Tisdale, that she put on the counter had grown. I have no secrets from you.
Of course not, dear.
He turned to look at me. The benefits of marrying a spy are that you always know that they're not telling the truth. Donna made pointed eye contact with Henry and me. I was not a spy. I was an administrator. A facilitator who made phone calls and got things done. I sipped my fancy beer. Donna, as long as you don't break the speed limit too much or write bad checks here in the county, I don't care what you did. And I hope your book is a bestseller. I pointed at the stack of papers. Is that the International Man of Mystery? She placed a steady hand on the pile and looked at me. Are you sure you really want to see this? I waited a second before replying.
Why do you say that?
She looked pained. Walt, there are things that are better not known. I mean, isn't it enough that you know who he is and that he's just a crazy old guy now? I glanced around as if the answer was obvious.
No.
She nodded. Whenever a field agent is involved with an operation, he's given a new name, history, everything. These cover stories are called legends. And the problem is that after an extended period of activity and a bunch of legends, some individuals exhibit marked psychological aberrations. They become the legend so well that they forget who they are, like an actor who becomes the role forever. Robert Littell wrote a really good book about one of them, fiction, of course, she smiled. And that's what happened to Tisdale? Donna picked up the papers and handed them to me. One of the things. I took them, folded them, and placed them in the inside pocket of my jacket, which was hanging on the back of my stool. He thinks he's Orrin Porter Rockwell. What were you guys trying to do, infiltrate the Mormon Tabernacle Choir? She laughed. Dale Tisdale really was CIA, unlike all these jaybirds around here who say they were. Just once, I'd like to get one of the fake ones crossways with me so I could show them what the real CIA is capable of. Henry read by the overhead map light as I drove.
So he hadn't lost his mind when he was in Mexico, which is a shame because I think I lost mine in Cabo one time. The Cheyenne Nation studied the papers. Sometimes it is a gradual process. I think that is what Donna was trying to intimate to us.
I steered the bullet south on I-25 through the chilling night and glanced past Henry toward the invisible mountains, taking comfort in knowing that they were there and that I was not climbing them. Why would the CIA send someone like that back into duty?
Possibly because they did not know how much of a psychological break he had sustained in Southeast Asia.
I gave the bear the horse eye. Kind of hard to miss a guy with a beard and hair down to his ass who claims to be an historical Western figure. He sighed.
As I said, it would appear that the Orrin Porter Rockwell manifestation of his character is relatively recent, say when he was arrested by the federal authorities in Mexico. It would appear that the CIA claimed that the entire operation was rogue and they hung Tisdale out to dry.
For the second time, at least. I shook my head. Remind me to never work for the CIA.
It is possible that some of it was a rogue undertaking. Tisdale conceived the idea and named it Operation Milkshake. Evidently, because of his specific skill set, he was put in charge of this operation in Mexico that involved the appropriation of crude oil. He stopped reading and gazed through the dark windshield. I recall a while back, the Justice Department found out American refineries had been buying massive quantities of stolen oil from the Mexican government. He turned to look at me. The bandits and drug gangs tap into pipelines out in these remote areas, and some of them were even building their own pipelines to siphon off hundreds of millions of dollars worth of oil a year.
So Operation Milkshake was not a penny ante operation?
No. And it would appear that a portion of the American government wanted to get in on the action.
His eyes dropped.
There were a number of subsequent investigations, indictments, and arrests, one of whom was Tisdale.
He shifted in his seat.
Operation Milkshake. That sounds strangely familiar. Where does that come from?
Albert Fall. The Secretary of the Interior under Harding was convicted of taking bribes for oil rights on public lands, namely from the Teapot Dome Naval Oil Reserves, just a little south of here. In a congressional hearing, the senator from New Mexico was famous for having made a statement about the process of directional oil drilling. If you have a milkshake and I have a milkshake, and my straw reaches across the room, I'll end up drinking your milkshake.
What a typically white venture.
I ignored the remark and continued. Tisdale appears to be something of an expert in history and would know that statement.
Whatever happened to Fall?
Died penniless in El Paso. I took the off-ramp at Powder Junction. Did the papers indicate where all this Mormon stuff comes from? The bear synopsized.
After an unfortunate incident with a Cessna Bonanza, the U.S. government denied his existence and reported him dead. The Mexican government left with an unidentified prisoner, dumped him in Penal del Altiplano, where he shared a cell with newfound Mormon Tomas Bidarte.
I turned and looked at him. You're kidding, Henry shrugged.
Evidently, Dale Tisdale converted to the point where he actually thought of himself as Orin Porter Rockwell. As a Caucasian finding himself in the environs of a maximum security prison in Mexico, it might have been a survival instinct and the only way he made it through.
So he and Bidarte were locked up together. I thought there was something that passed between them when they shook hands down at East Spring. I stopped at the sign at the bottom of the interstate ramp alongside the rest stop. How did he get out?
The Cheyenne Nation nodded.
As you have surmised, with Bidarte's help, they bribed their way to freedom by selling Tisdale's landholdings in East Spring Ranch to Roy Lanier.
Well, I'll be damned. I made the left through the underpass and stopped at the next sign where the short drop road crossed Old Highway 87. A Powder River Fire District truck approached from the south with its siren and lights going, but made a left before getting to us.
He was picked up in Utah by the highway patrol while kneeling by a roadside cross. He was then incarcerated in a psychiatric ward for observation, but once he admitted to having lived in Wyoming, they shipped him off to Evanston.
Why didn't they contact his family?
At that point, he claimed to have no living relatives and asserted to be the Orin Porter Rockwell. And before anyone could ascertain just who he was, he escaped.
So he lived a legend.
It would appear so.
We sat there in the darkness at the four-way stop in Powder Junction, Wyoming, the caution light intermittently flashing and giving me the feeling it was a metaphor. I listened as the siren from the volunteer fire truck stopped. It didn't sound all that far away. And why is he here now, protecting his grandson? Who contacted him? Who knew he was still alive? Bidarte?
The answer to that question does not appear to be in the file.
The big Cheyenne Indian looked at me with a sad smile.
What about the daughter?
I sat there idling, unavailable for comment, and not very popular with her parents. He nodded, the yellow light flickering its warmth on the reflective surface of his dark eyes.
Now everything leads to Mexico, Operation Milkshake, and the Apostolic Church of the Lamb of God.
Agreed. Another truck pulled up across the road and sat there, obviously waiting for me to go first, so I reached down and flicked the lever, throwing my brights at him so that he'd know it was okay to proceed.
Double Tough says the Teapot Dome reserves are tapped out and that the federal government tried to sell the place off to private developers, but nobody bit.
Then why are they here? I blinked my lights at the truck again. Obviously, he'd noticed the stars and bars on my vehicle and figured it was a trick. According to Vic, this is the end of the world, and maybe they're what they say they are, religious zealots looking for a place to be left alone. Wouldn't be the first time that type has turned up on the high plains. The bear completed my thought.
The drill bit, the weapons, and...
And what?
One of these things is not like the others. Tom Lockhart, Tomas Bidarte, the man Gloss. Some of these individuals do not seem to fit the religious modus operandi.
I flipped on my light bar for an instant,
just to give the guy in the truck an official assurance he could go ahead. Anyway, I just want to know what's happened to Sarah Tisdale.
So when we get through at the substation, we are continuing on to Short Drop?
You read my mind. I watched as the truck lurched from across the road and pulled alongside us. The driver rolled his window down, and I recognized him, Powder Junction's mayor.
Brian, what's the matter with you? Are you drunk?
Kinnison, who was usually smiling, looked very serious for a change and perplexed.
What? Why were you just sitting there? I thought you might want to get by. Walt, the sheriff's substation is on fire.
The Powder River Fire District truck was pouring water onto the Quonset hut with four different high-powered hoses, but with the flames rippling through the broken windows, it looked to me as if the building was well on its way to melting. I forced my way through the volunteer firemen. Doubletuff's Suburban was parked a little ways away in the lot, and I remembered how he had said he was sleeping in the back of the office to give Freimeyer and his fiancée a little privacy. I turned back to the inferno. I've got a man in there. The fire chief, a fellow by the name of Gilbert, wearing full gear with a rubber coat and leather helmet with face shield, threw a hand on my chest.
We checked. There's nobody in there, Sheriff. How about the back room?
The look on his face told me he wasn't sure, and I started pushing past him, the cool coming over my face along with the stillness in my hands.
One of my deputies, he was sleeping in the back.
He grabbed hold of me.